Interrobang.
Hi, from catskill.net, I'm Dave DeGraw, and you're listening to Interrobang. On today's episode, I'm very fortunate to be joined by my buddy Sam, who goes by the artist name 2XAA online and makes music mostly with the NanoLoop handheld. He's also a creative technologist. He has an open source NanoLoop clone called OpenLoop, as well as an open source visualizer library called ModV that we're actually going to talk about in this episode. But beyond that, he's just a very thoughtful and creative person, very inspiring to chat with. And I'm very lucky to call him my friend. So let's get right into it. Welcome back to Interrobang. Today I'm joined by my friend Sam, aka 2XAA. Sam and I, we just kind of rubbed shoulders through the chip scene, chip music community. He was a super nice guy, helped me out with this crazy LED visualizer project that I rigged up back in 2015. And since then, we've just been kind of buds. And he does a lot of beyond chiptune. Now he's doing a lot of really interesting augmented reality, virtual reality. But then more than that, using the web as a platform to do things that are not hypermedia documents, if that makes sense. And we can get all into that. But basically, I just want to say welcome, Sam, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, it's been 10 years, pretty much, I think, but since that Skype call. What was it for your brother's band?
No, dude, I was just messing with it one day. And I think maybe I offered it to some local musicians that I was I could. There was a band in Provo in the city I was living in called Conquer Monster that we were actually kind of a chiptune band, and they're pretty good. It was like a duo, and I was maybe going to help them out with some visualizers, but nothing ever came of it. I was just in college at the time, but I still have that video on my Instagram page, and it's sweet. Cause it was a nanopixel display RGB, and then you had it how did the audio input work? It was an analog, you just plugged the headphones straight into it, right? And then
that was it. Yeah. So that was Teensy based.
Yeah, Teensy.
And you can, what, I think Teensy, it was Teensy 3 that I was using at that point. Back then? Yeah, Teensy 3, I think. And that didn't last very long, actually, the Teensy 3. That got superseded quite quickly. It's funny, actually, I was looking on the Teensy website the other day, and they were like, we can still sell you a Teensy 3, but don't buy it because it's not supported. And I was like, okay, just stop selling it. You could, it had some very good analog input on the Teensy 3, which could, basically just read a straight analog signal directly just by soldering a headphone jack onto it, essentially. And then you use the Teensy audio library to get the FFT and do some stuff. And that's it. I think I wrote an RMS function in there, and that's a Rubin squared function. I stole it from a friend's audio processing library, which is what all of my visuals are based upon. And anyway, RMS is this magic source. If you have FFT array, don't worry about the bass, don't worry about the mids, don't worry about the highs, just run the whole thing through RMS. Doesn't matter what genre you're on, if the music's pumping, your visuals will be pumping with this one value. Okay.
Let me break that
down.
That's
it. It's magic.
FFT is fast Fourier transform.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what that is.
Okay. I don't really understand how it works, but what I do understand is you send a signal into an audio signal.
Yeah.
Or an AC signal, whatever you've got.
Yeah.
Into this transform function, and it basically gives you frequency bins. So it's going to tell you what that signal is comprised of. So frequency binning is basically saying okay, I've got a bunch of a bunch of bins, a bunch of baskets, and this waveform is made up of blocks of little okay, here's the bass, here's another bass frequency in a different bin, it might be a bit higher. So if you imagine an instrument, you're basically it's almost binning notes. You start off on the lowest ones, and it's okay, that's a C note, and that goes in that bin. Okay, but you're also playing a chord, so you might be playing an E and a G, and we're gonna bin those in their respective bins, and then the higher the number of things in those bins, the frequency is comprised of these.
More bass heavy, more treble heavy, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And that's, I think, probably one of the simplest ways to drill down into what FFT is, but essentially, in those bins you have numbers, and then it's going to be more bass heavy, more treble heavy, more mid heavy, whatever. But people, I think, get held up on how do I make a something bounce with a number. that's easy, right? Like if, you know, if you've got like, I don't know, let's pick an object off my table of things here. Let's say we've got a sprite of a Game Boy on the screen, right? And it's very small back here. We're going to say, okay, we're going to increase the scale, and it's going to, and that scale value is going to be like zero here and then one here.
Yeah.
And then as you know, each frame you're reading the new FFT, and then one of those bins, so maybe around the base level, that base bin is going to go from zero to one at some point. And you're going to be like moving that forwards and back and maybe in the middle a bit. And then when the kick drum is happening, it's kind of doing that. But that's only good for one song. Or maybe a few songs in the same thing, because each song uses a different kick drum at a different frequency.
I see. Okay.
So, or even genre, right? So maybe you're doing visuals for a show and a DJ is like, okay, I'm just going to, you know, throw in something completely different now. And you're like, oh God, all of my visuals don't work anymore. You can do kind of filtering and like say, okay, I want all of these bass bins and then use that. But again, the bass frequencies within the actual bass in the song rather than the kick drums, then don't, you know, they mix in and get all muddled. RMS, root mean squared, is essentially a calculation on the FFT values. Again, I don't know how it works. I stole it from a friend's audio processing library. They are much smarter than I am with audio processing, but root mean squared is this magic source where you just give it the whole FFT. You get one number, that's it. And your one number is going to be the bouncy number that you just want to do all of your visuals off. Cool. Doesn't matter if it's techno, drum and bass, classical music even, it's just going to work. It's some magic, amazing
thing. So you're saying, regardless of the song, regardless of whatever you're doing, you take all the FFT values, put them through an RMS, and like it's gonna work. It's going to look okay.
Yeah,
that's cool. Because I've heard exactly. About RMS in terms of like AC power, like when they say it's like
same thing,
120 volt RMS. I don't even understand root mean squared. It's like because the power level is actually way higher than that, but also lower than that. Some math that I don't understand. But dude, that's crazy because, and this is what we need to get into, okay? And when I talk about Sam doing weird, not like weird, just like, okay, most web developers today, they're like, okay, I have like a CRUD app, right? Like create, read, update, destroy. It's like, you have a user. It's basically, we're building CRMs. Most of the professional development work I do is just like getting data from one bucket into another bucket to like make it work. And half the time it doesn't even freaking work. You don't do any of that stuff. Like you're not in that world. You're not like writing SQL. You're not like dealing with, migrating these giant production databases. You write a piece of software called ModV. Is that correct? And ModV is all we're talking about. It's a music visual. Think about like, and I'm trying to boil this down way, way down. Think about the Winamp, you know, the Windows Media Player audio visualizer that you used to look at. Sam basically builds that, but in the browser, and you can control it and program it. So it's designed to be used for live visuals, correct?
That's for it. You. Yeah. And like, yeah, the Windows Media Player visualizer is one of the biggest influences, I reckon, on that awesome. Program. Yeah. Yeah. So ModV started in 2014, I think. And it was, so we have to go back. Yeah. There's a lot. So ModV, it started in 2014. It wasn't really called ModV at that point, but it quickly became that over the few months that I started first developing it. I built it as part of a week-long kind of like coding and designing for kids week. So that's how I got into, well, not that year, but a few years previous, I actually got into university through this course, this like, you know, meetup thing. We can unpack that later maybe. But this week of kind of like, you know, developing and programming, it's all across the UK. So I was in the Plymouth Centre. I'm from Plymouth, in the southwest of England. And yeah, this course was, you know, like it would be kind of like maybe your local school or university or library or community space would be able to participate in this and invite, you know, kids 9 to 18 to go to one of these centers within this week and then, you know, learn how to code, or if they already knew how to code, flex their skills a little bit and pair them up with people who knew how to design, and you build something across the week. There's no theme. It's just you build something. Cool. That's it. And you've had mentors there who know how to code, and then they're gonna, you know, kind of like, you know, give you advice and kind of, you know, like, you know, make sure that you're on the right track and stuff. And there's food throughout the day and drinks and, you know, like it was a good time.
Cool.
That specific, I think, event doesn't happen anymore. I think there was some management issues internally, but anyway, I think I went to the first one as an 18-year-old, I think in 2011, potentially 2010. I can't remember how old I am or what the dates are, but around that time, anyway. And then I went back as a volunteer two or three times. And I think one of the first times I played some music. Oh, sorry. At the end of the week, all the kids across the different centers go to one specific big center. I think the one that I'd been to before was in Birmingham. And it was this huge, you know, kind of like event, essentially, where people within the technology and design industries, like, you know, fairly well-known people. I can't actually think of anyone off the top of my head, but I do know some developers that I've known who have done like developer relation kind of stuff, be judges at this event.
Cool.
You basically get split up into like different heats, essentially, right? And then you have to present your work. So it's not only about like the design and the programming, but it gives kids that experience of actually kind of presenting their work in kind of like a short time frame where you actually, it's like an elevator pitch, right? That they have to do, and they have to show their work and, you know, describe why it's good and, you know, blah 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 blah. And again, there's no real constraints, so like I don't really know how they chose the thing, because the first app that I wrote as a participant there was turning tweets into music.
Oh, cool.
With a guy called Simon, and we got to the final presentation, you know, presenting a work to, you know, a hall of maybe over 1,000 people, which was scary. Yeah. And it didn't work. It only worked in the heats that we were in.
The demo didn't work in the main one. Oh no.
No, not at all. I don't know why, but anyway, it's crazy. Anyway, ModV came out of one of these weeks, and while I was there as a volunteer, and do you know Pixel Hate?
Yes, he's like music tech.
A bit of a name in the Yes, exactly. So Pixel Hate was part of this I think he was actually one of the founders of this event.
Oh, cool.
Matthew Applegate, and he, I think, saw me play some music. Oh no, he asked actually if I would play some music at one of these events. I think as a volunteer. Yeah, the second time I came back, and then the third time I came back, the main center had actually moved from Birmingham to Plymouth. So at the end of the week, everyone was coming down to my home city. So that was really cool. But Matthew, I think, had left the organization at that point, and then somebody got in contact and was like, "Do you want to organize the music? Because you went to the uni here, you know the space, you know the people, you also know music people, you know, cool." in chiptune. And I was like, okay, brilliant. So I organized the music. It was myself, Jewel, Ms. Kai, one of my lecturers called Mike Blow, who does very experimental digital art music, very cool guy, and the Virus Empire.
I think I've seen you guys talk to each other. I think I've checked some of his stuff out. It's a memorable.
Really? Thing. Cool. Interesting. That's cool. Man, you have eyes everywhere. It's crazy. It's wild the amount of stuff that you knew, because I sent you a link before even on this podcast, and you were like, "Oh, I'll reread that." I'm like, "There's no way you've read
the Chiptography 2XA interview 2020 behind the lens."
Yeah.
Chiptography. I mean, we can get into all that, man. But dude, okay. So at this point,
let's wrap up Mopi.
Oh yeah. Go ahead.
Real quick, sorry. So at this party, right, I wanted to invite somebody doing visuals, but I reached out to Hello Cat Food and a couple of other people that I knew, and just everyone was busy. So I was like, okay, I have a week. What can I build within a week?
That's cool, man.
So I started building ModV in the browser, because I knew kind of about Canvas, and I kind of played, I think, around with it a little bit. Canvas is an element in
HTML
document where you can draw pixels to. So where you would, like, you know, normally kind of like maybe move boxes around or kind of like move around HTML elements with animations through something called CSS. This is actually like it's more like a Photoshop document where you can literally move blocks of
pixels. Draw anything
around.
Anywhere. I've never messed. And honestly, like, sorry to interrupt you, but I think that that kind of is like fundamental difference in the kind of web developer you are versus the kind of web developer I am, because I view Canvas at like, that's not the web. Like the web is like hypermedia documents with anchor tags you can click. So it's like, it's almost like the Flash days, like when people used to build these really fancy websites in Flash, and it's like, well, good luck with that in like 2 years, you know what I mean? But so that's what I mean. Yeah. Canvas is not Flash though. And like, and I do want to get into all harder. Of this, because the web being the ultimate platform is, I think, something we've already discussed and something that I'm very passionate about. Like,
I love it.
Closed platforms just will, like, it's like we're talking about with the Vision Pro. It's like they just can never succeed. It has to be open. So anyways, yeah, talk to me more about ModV using Canvas and all that.
Yeah, so the first version of ModV was this one that I built in the week, and actually it allowed people to control the visuals, because
one thing that I know, community control thing, is that the idea? I was reading about that. Yes.
Yes, that's it. Right. So yeah, that was the video that you commented on. So from way, way back, I think. Anyway, so that was the first version, essentially, where on your phone, I actually, funnily enough, I have one here. I basically replicated the Chaos Pad.
Cool.
So on the Chaos Pad, you've got this XY control thing. So you'll see in a second. Yes, thank you. As I move to the top left, that's 8.8, that's 8.1, that's 1.1, and then 1.8. Yep. So as I move it around, you have two values, one in the X direction and then one in the Y direction. And I put that on a phone, essentially. And so every minute, anyone who's connected to the controller website will be able to control the visuals from their phone with a couple of buttons here, I think, to change colors or the visual style. And then there were two parameters within these presets that they could scroll through, that they could change. But it was still audio reactive in the background as well, so they couldn't change the audio reactivity, but they could change stuff like element sizes and kind of like, you know, what was happening and I don't know, scaling.
That's
so and stuff
cool. That's so cool, dude.
I don't think I built the whole thing in a week. I think I actually started it just before I went down, but yeah, the WebSocket stuff was stuff I'd already played around with previously, I think within uni and one job that I had worked on as well outside of uni. So yeah, that was the first version, and then I showed it to a few friends of mine, and they were like, that's really cool stuff. Maybe you should, you know, build this into an actual thing. I was like, okay. So it's been just over 10 years, I think.
Wow.
I haven't touched it since last year, basically, but it's been a pretty crazy time recently. So
if I want to become a VJ, I can go learn ModV and like that can be my ticket.
Exactly, it's open source. There is documentation. It hasn't crashed for me in a while, so it's probably not so bad to use.
But you're using Vue.js for it, aren't you? Or no?
Yeah, for the UI. Yeah,
for the UI elements, use Vue.js. But to do the actual visualization, it's Canvas.
Yes. Yeah. So actually, the state management is all in Vuex as well, which is Vue's older now.
I know what Vuex state manager. Is. Yeah, man. I hate Vuex, to be honest with you. So.
Really?
Yeah. I hate state management. I feel like state management was like the epitome of like the JavaScript like dark days. But anyways, I'm crazy. I'm wild. I'm all in on web components, dude. That's like the only thing I even want to touch anymore is web components. Yeah. Yeah. I gave up on Vue.js.
Yeah.
Anyways. So to do the actual visualization synthesis. I know that there's like native browser API, like web audio API. Are you doing anything like that, or are you just basically doing the raw math in JavaScript and then just drawing pixels onto the canvas?
No. So what I'm doing is, this is kind of one thing that really, I think helped me get started with ModV so quickly, which was a friend of mine who I met through, I think I met him through this programming event, this week thing, or at a hackathon or through fans. I really can't remember. It's been such a long time. But the guy's name is Hugh Rawlinson, and him and a couple of uni friends built this audio processing library in the browser, which uses web audio, called Mader. And Mader is fantastic. It does all sorts of very, very cool audio processing for you. So like the Rhythmian Squared stuff, which is, yeah, you know, as we were talking before, it's like, how loud is the song essentially? It does energy, which is a derivative of Rhythmian Squared. It does chroma sampling as well, where I was talking about putting notes into bins before for FFT. It's not quite, FFT isn't quite like that. It's more like frequency ranges being put into bins.
Okay.
Which is, well, I mean, that is what it's doing. Yeah. I was just trying to kind of like keep it a little bit more simple. But chroma binning actually puts notes into bins. So, you know, like a chromatic tuner for a guitar, for example.
Yes.
It's going to like, you know, it knows kind of where that is. So chroma binning is that, and it's basically what one of these bins is the highest one, and then it's going to kind of, you know, say, okay, well, that's a G, or, you know.
So you're saying that's what chromatic subsampling
is? Made is really powerful.
Chromatic subsampling is FFT essentially.
It might be. I don't. So
you're kind of blowing my mind, dude. Because like the chroma to me always means like color. So, but then you say chromatic tuner, and it's like, oh, I know what a chromatic tuner is. A chromatic tuner, you plug your guitar into it, and I don't know how it works, but it's like it'll tell you if it's low or high or right on the money, right? Like I don't know how it works, but they're cheap and they're easy to do. I know the technology's common, but. You're blowing my mind. Chromatic.
So, chromatic binning, just with a quick Google into the Mater docs, I can describe it a little bit easier because I've literally not read the docs for 5 years or so. The description is literally calculates how much of each chromatic pitch class, C sharp, D, D sharp, E, blah, 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 exists in the signal. So it's used to analyze the harmonic content of recorded music, such as in a chord or key detection. So chromatic pitch in this case, it just means what note in the chromatic scale.
Interesting. That's cool.
Right? So C to B.
So ModB uses this library to do a lot of the, like, they have all these crazy algorithms and in your import, and that's like a JS, like an NPM kind of thing that you import. That's cool.
Literally. Yeah. So in ModB, you pick an audio source, could be a microphone, could be a sound card, etc. Any one of the system, you know, input devices. And then within ModV, you also select a few visual generators called modules, and they're in a big gallery. And there's a few different renderers for, you know, different technologies which can render these. The big ones, I guess, in there are the interactive shader format, which is a very specific format of shader where it has like a bit of JSON in a comment in the top of the shader, and it just describes the inputs and the outputs of that shader.
Okay.
Like props in a component, right? So
the only shaders I'm familiar with are Shader Toy, like .hsls or whatever, but I honestly don't even really understand that. I've used I don't know if you listened to the last episode with Keaton, but he was talking about like getting into writing shaders with ChatGPT, and I've had ChatGPT write me some basic shaders, but I assume that this is a different format than that. But this is cool because
The same. It's just JSON blob on the top. It's exactly the same. It's just with a JSON blob on the top.
Oh, that's cool. Cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I totally lost my train of thought. I was going to say that. I don't know. I wrote down some notes here though. And okay, let's change topics a bit if that's okay.
Yeah.
ModV, I can become the next world's greatest VJ. But there's a path you took to get you there, right? You talked about being involved in this kind of was it like a publicly funded event then, like the hackathon thing, or was it like a private like partnership, or like, I mean, is this like a government sponsored thing, or
I have no idea where they got the money from. Yeah, I think it was free to go to, so it must have been partly, it was definitely sponsored by some tech companies, I think, and it must have also got some government funding. I got a job actually working for some government agency, like a one-time job through this thing, so I'm assuming it must have got some government
money.
Yeah.
It's just very interesting to me to hear about, like, kind of, It's not even necessarily different than how the government here might do a program like that, but it's just interesting to hear in another country with another government, like how it would also work, you know, theoretically, because things in the U.S. I can only imagine, but like we do have things like that, but it's like very entrepreneurial focused, like very, like, it's not like, oh, like just have fun, like, and present it. It's like, are you going to be the next $1 billion startup kind of thing? Like there's like 10-year-old kids out here that are like on Shark Tank. I don't know if you have that. Well, in the UK, it's called Dragon's Den, right?
Dragon's Den. Yeah.
Anyways. But there's a path, right? And you talked about like you'd already gone through university, you were a musician, you'd already got into chiptune at this point. So talk to me. Well, and I read, and we can, I would highly recommend to the listener to go read the interview with Chiptography. I'll link it in the show notes, but talk to me just a little bit about, like, I don't want to necessarily rehash the history that you told her, but just the parts that are pertinent. Like, what does chip music mean to you, and why are you involved in it? Why did you get involved in it, and what do you feel like about it in the future?
Yeah, this is, well, not only is this a test, but, you know, I've talked about that. We did that interview right after the show in 2019 that I put on with Shirobon, and we invited
Legendary.
USK from Japan. Legendary. We invited, we invited, who else did we invite? God, Jellica played first set. Yeah, we got Saberpulse. No, not Saberpulse. We got, oh no, who am I talking about? Oh, my brain. C-Trix.
C-Trix
played. I don't.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Henry Hemsweet, I don't think he played there, but I played, Shirobon played. We had some visualists from Belgium, I think, and who I cannot for the life of me remember the name of at this point. It was a big night, at least. It was huge. And it was one of the, it was like just before, I think it was like October of 2019. And it was just before, of course, you know, the whole world got put into the big pandemic. Anyway, I did the, and I haven't organized a show since. Wow. But I did that interview with Marjorie Chiptography the day after that show. So I was very tired, very hungover. And she wasn't. Amazingly, I was like, God damn it. I think, oh, Sinai Danson played there as well. Okay. So Marie.
Cool.
And because, yeah, Marie and C-Trix were both staying in my place as well.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
I was in a shared house with four other people at that point. And I don't know, this is probably not a thing in the US, really, maybe. But older UK houses have like a big hot water tank. And then once you've used up all the hot water, there's no more hot water until it turns back on. They were not they were not used to that, and they got in the shower and they were like, it's freezing. I was like, oh shit. Anyway, the weird memories. But yes, what does chiptune mean to me, and what was the other question? I don't know, man,
but I want to talk more about that, because that's crazy. You're telling me you have C-Trix and Sinai Danson on your, how do you is that, did I pronounce it right? Sinai Danson. Sleeping on your floor in your like apartment, and then Marjorie shows up to like interview you, and you're like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, because I was quite like, I was like, yeah, Marjorie, come over at 12, we'll be absolutely, you know,
the day
we'll
after be up and ready and show.
Yeah, and then I of course forgot there was going to be an after party at someone's place, so yeah, went to the after party, I think. I don't remember much of the after party, but we got back at like 3-4 a.m. maybe.
Oh my gosh.
I can't remember. It was a late one for sure. But yeah, it was so fun, you know, like, and it was in this tiny little sweatbox called The Glove That Fits in Hackney in London. And literally, like, you know, sweat was dripping off the walls, you know, it was like so, so small. And that, to me anyway, like, you know, like those venues are the best ones, you know, like, you know, where you just get, you just get into whatever's going on, regardless of who's playing. Like, you know, if you're in a smaller venue, you have to move. You have to be part of the event. You know, there's no standing at the back and being like, ugh, whatever. You know, there's no space for that. Like, you've got to be part of it or you can't be part of it. And that's it. And I really, really like that.
I think the smallest chip show, probably the smallest show, the smallest and most packed show I've ever been to is one of the Square Sounds Tokyo after parties and one of the little tiny underground bars where they have like Hollywood show up, and like there's like 75, like, dude, like the size of this little hotel room I'm in, you know, like just absolutely tiny, tiny, tiny bar. But yeah. Like, yeah, I know what you mean, man. The feeling is, and I think it's mutual. The fans can't hide. Like, you can't hide in the corner and do drugs. Like, no. Artist can't hide in the green room and do drugs. Like, I mean, I'm saying drugs, but like Hallie walks on stage.
Yeah, I mean,
there is no stage. Like, and to some extent, like Squaretown's Tokyo itself at Koenji High, like, is such a legendary venue, but they have like a green room. And I didn't like that. Like, the artists don't hang out more. I went to, Little Sound Assembly. It was like a very small chip festival in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And it was like the opposite of that. It was like, yeah, like a weekend festival, but they were like, like nobody really was there besides the artists that were playing. Like, almost, it kind of made, you've been to Chipwrecked, right? So, and maybe like,
yes,
Chipwrecked doesn't get like a lot of like people. It's mostly just like people that want to come camp and hang out and like play chiptune together, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
That's it. So Chipwrecked is on this tiny island off of Denmark. It's like between Denmark and, well, it's kind of like beside Denmark and Sweden. It is part of Denmark, but the way that people usually get there is fly into Copenhagen in Denmark. Then they take a coach out to across the bridge to Sweden. Then they take a ferry out of Sweden back into Denmark.
Wow.
And onto this tiny island called, wow, Bornholm. And the pilgrimage, you know, I missed the first few shipwrecks, and I it was just impossible for me to actually go and do it. I think I said I was going to play a few years in a row, and then I didn't, and then I got really embarrassed for like another 2 years that I wasn't able to make it. And then I finally got there, I think after COVID, potentially, 22. I was there 23, didn't make it last year, but came. I'm going again in, yeah, next month. So,
oh, really?
Liked it. Yes, really, really good, you know. And you know, like, it's also in the middle of nowhere on the island itself, and the island is so small, it's literally like, it's almost as central as you can possibly get on the island, and there's basically like no shops around, you know, like you've got to walk a good half an hour to like the nearest thing. And if you don't drive, then you know it's you're walking, essentially. What I'm doing this time, though, I've camped every time I've been there with a tiny like one person tent, which I could throw in my bag on the plane.
I remember seeing your Instagram posts or your Twitter posts of you camping when you get shipwrecked, and I was like, Sam's, he's living it, he's doing well.
It's one bag, yeah. With all my clothes, my whole setup, my camping,
that's legit
gear, and that's the music.
Yeah, tell me more about
that. That's it. Yeah, it's a great festival. You know, I think it's like 80 people potentially maximum, maybe 100 at its peak.
Wow.
But I would say that it's different, you know. So like, I went to the Superbike festivals. I caught three of them, I think, maybe four of them. I didn't catch the first two, but I was there for the rest of them. I never made it to any US chip gigs apart from when I was randomly over in New York last year. My work needed me to go to the US Open.
You got together with Drip and everything, right? And did you guys put it together?
That's right,
a show,
yeah.
Or did you just hang out?
No, there was, it was 8static. It was the revival of 8static down in Philly, and Drip drove me down there.
So did you perform there, or did you just go?
I did, yeah, and Sinai Dancer Marie was there as well, and I didn't even know she was in New York at the time. I was like, oh my god, this is amazing fate. This is ridiculous. And I wasn't even meant to be in the US, really. I couldn't have hung out if the actual thing that I was going over for with my work was actually happening, but they couldn't refund the flights. So they were like, do you want to just move some holiday around and take the flights? I was like, yes, I absolutely want to do that.
So you ended up going to New York for free, essentially.
For a week, yeah, practically. And I stayed with a friend of a friend. They were out of town, and they were like, okay, you know, stay in their apartment. I was like, yes, okay, fantastic. Yeah, it was brilliant. And 8static was amazing. I played some Nanoloop Mono. Sorry, we'll get back to Shipwreck. This is drifting so hard. But yeah, I played some Nanoloop Mono tunes that I've been working on with the new Lego cart, which is really nice.
Oh, wait, show me that again. Hold on. I haven't seen that. I don't even know what you're talking about. Nanoloop changes their stuff up. What the heck?
Yeah.
Oh, with Lego cart. Yes.
Yeah, so this is Mono, the one with the synthesizer in it.
And you actually use the audio out on the cartridge itself instead of the Game Boy audio out?
So that's audio out at the top. But yeah, that's the cartridge, which that's is mad, right? Cool. Like, one of these is a PIC chip. I think it's, yeah. So that the square one is a PIC chip, just and that's PIC? What's doing the. Everyone. That's what's, yeah, I think there's PIC, and then the other one I think is flash potentially.
Yeah,
it's, but the PIC like is doing. Yeah, it's crazy, but like
for the people listening at home that don't know, the Game Boy cartridge edge. We're talking about the original Game Boy. Sam's holding up a Game Boy cartridge called Nanoloop Mono. The original Game Boy has a feature that a lot of people didn't know about. That one of the pins on the cartridge connector is literally just an audio input. Yeah, look at that. There's just a wire soldered. Did you make that? Is that a DIY thing?
Yeah, I designed the.
That's the old print version. And
just, yeah, 3D printed it, and I figured out the audio out there.
So, but that doesn't use the well. How does that work? Because it doesn't use the audio input on the Game Boy. Like, does it send the audio from the cartridge? And can you play the audio from Nanoloop Mono over the Game Boy speaker?
Yeah. So that's through. So it's pin 31 on the cartridge. This side, I think. Yeah. I can't remember.
Over on the
one end. Of the sides, anyway. Yes, and it sends the audio from the reconfigured PIC chip, which in this version, the one that I was just holding up for the listeners, that is a sandwich, I think, triple layer PCB with the components inside the PCB.
Yeah,
which is crazy, beautiful.
That's why, like, it's the amazing stuff. Oliver, is it pronounced Oliver? The work he does on the physical hardware production, I've just always respected, and I respected the hustle. He's like, I mean, I myself am like a chiptune shop guy that has come and gone. You know, like Oliver's been around for at this point. He's been selling Nanoloop for over 20 years. We can move on from Chipwrecked. I just wanted to mention because do you know Defense Mechanism? Was he there any of the years that you have you interacted with him at all?
I only online, I think. Yeah. I'm not sure if we. Oh no, wait. Yes, he was 23, I think.
Yeah, I know he. I've talked to him a couple times, and he's always just loved going to Chipwrecked and.
Anyways, yeah. Okay. So sorry to describe Chipwreck properly in a sentence which doesn't last more than 2 minutes is. It's a very small chiptune festival in the middle of nowhere, essentially. Of nowhere.
They
in the
have it in like
the
an
sea,
old barn. Like the photos I've seen was it's like a shed. Like not to even call it a barn is like it's like an old shed.
Yeah, practically. So it's genuinely an old barn, but it hasn't been used as a barn for a very long time. So it's on the back of this guy's farm, and he does, I think he keeps a few animals on there. Anders Holm is the guy who runs Chipwrecked, and it's his land, it's his home.
Wow.
Actually on here.
Wow.
Yeah, and he just invites people to come and play as part of Chipwrecked, and you know, as an artist, I think you know, you can turn up and then be, you know, play on one of two stages. One is in the barn and one is on the outside of the barn. There's a video, I think, of me playing some Nanoloop 2 stuff from 23.
Yeah, I remember.
And if you look carefully in the first few beats of that set, you'll see part of the barn actually fall off. because the bass is so loud.
The roof, dude.
Literally. Yeah. I think they actually repaired the barn potentially last year or the year before to actually really shore it up because there were real concerns that the whole thing was just going to fall down. Apart from that, it's an incredible festival, and it's one of those experiences which you will never have at a traditional music festival. You know, like, there's a traditional music festival, you don't get to know anyone there properly. You might find, like, two people that you know, or their group of people that you might bump into, and that's, like, a really cool moment. But at Chipwrecked, that is the group.
Yep.
You know? You can just talk to anyone, you know, everyone is so friendly. Everyone is just kind of all, it's the small venue thing again. Everyone's in it. And if you're not in it, you're not, like, that's it. It's like, you can go and sit down somewhere else and have a drink and just chill out for a bit. And that's what you can do at Chipwrecked. It's either you can go sit down and have a drink, or you can join in with the music, and there's nothing else to do.
Yep.
And that's it for, you know, I think it's like three evenings of, no, or two, I can't remember. It's one of the best things I think I've ever been to.
That feeling is exactly the feeling I was describing at Square or Little Sound Assembly, where it's just like, like you're just like, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was in the middle of nowhere, like in the US.
Yeah.
Geographically is kind of the middle of nowhere, but you're just there because you want to be there. I'm also heavily, well, for a while I was heavily involved in the King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard community. I don't know if you heard of that band. Yeah. It's Australian psychedelic.
Well, through a couple of friends and mainly through you. Yes.
Yeah. I ended up kind of following them on tour a couple of years ago, but that's the same thing. It's like, hanging out around people that are just there for the music because they're passionate about it. There's just nothing like it.
Nice.
And with the chiptune thing, and I think you kind of hit it on the head, right? You showed up, you showed your Chaos Pad. We're talking about you throw a couple of Game Boys, you know, if you're feeling splurgy, maybe you'll throw your Game Boy Pocket and your, you know, Game Boy Advance. Yeah. Oh, wait, hold on. Show those again. Hold on. I wasn't looking. Is that pink? Oh, it's silver and silver.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's just the light.
Two silver. Yes. Dude, I have the exact same Game Boy Pocket. I just put it up on my shelf that I bought at Hard Off in Tokyo in the junk bin for like 500 yen, you know, and it worked perfectly. Like, still has
the, that's so good. There's an app. I don't know if it's in the US, in the UK though, called Vinted, and it's meant for selling clothes. Uh-huh. But people have then now started just selling all sorts of other stuff on there. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of people know, and I'm probably giving the secret away, but you can buy really, really cheap retro tech off Vinted. Like this, I think was £40.
Nice.
Where on eBay, this would be like at least double that.
A Game Boy, you know? That's, and dude, I just can't help. That's, we're getting old, man.
Nope. No lines on the screen.
Perfectly.
Perfect condition.
So how much do you think the Game Boy Micro is worth? That's my question.
Oh, they are horrendously expensive.
Like, how much?
I cannot. I think on eBay, I'm looking at them and they're like £80+, you know? And I'm like, that's horrific, you know?
I know for $20.
They're definitely a rarer console. They're a rarer console because it was end of life, you know?
But they're so... The thing is so...
That's mad.
Can
you buy one and send one to me, please?
Yeah, if I find one, I'll send you a...
Thank you.
Dude, because that would be the ultimate flex. I can't remember who's done it, but like people have done like nanoloop sets on a Game Boy Micro.
Oh,
and I know like objectively, there's no reason to do it. Like the audio is not better. Maybe it was Henry Helmsley. I can't remember, but like it's just so small. In that scenario, you could have two Game Boy Micros in your pants. Like, you don't even need a backpack. You don't even need a backpack. You just have your...
No.
Some cargo pants maybe, and you're good, dude. Couple audio cables.
Yeah. Headphones around the head. You buy the TX6 as a tiny mixer. So that's one pocket.
Yes. How much is that, though, dude? You want to talk about expensive things, man. Oh, it looks so cool. It's Lego. It looks so cool.
Yeah. It's brilliant. And you won't be able to, I think, actually get really the appreciation of this specifically on camera here, but maybe I can find it. Oh, yeah. Here it is. I'm for the listener as well. I'm holding up a Teenage Engineering TX6, which is a pocket-sized, I would say probably like analog to a home studio desk, as in mixer, audio mixer. It's got six. I mean, I'm going to do the sales pitch now, but six stereo inputs. Each input has 24 dB trim. You've got filter on each input. You've got EQ on each input. Like three band, you've got compressor, trim, panning, of course, and then you've got two global effects. You've got the most beautiful jack I've ever seen in the world.
Yeah,
and just listen to this. Hold on, maybe it'll come through. Maybe that didn't come through. It's not coming through. The noise canceling is too good. But this click. Hold on, maybe I can just show it.
Yeah.
That is ridiculously nice.
Are the inputs all 3.5 or are they all 1/4 inch?
They are all 3.5.
Cool.
And they're very, very tightly spaced. So you have to buy very thin cables.
Then the output is 1/4 inch?
The output is 1/4 inch. You've got an aux out. You've got an aux in. You've got a headphone out a headphone out and microphone input.
Cool.
And then you've got your 1/4 inch with
crazy. S3.5. So you literally could show up with two Game Boy Micros, that thing, like in your pocket. Yeah. You don't even need cargo pants.
In one pocket.
In one pocket.
Yeah. Probably. It's crazy. And like, this is, This has definitely had a bad rep, I think, from a lot of people. Everyone's like, why is it so small? Why is it so expensive? I'm like, mate, look, like, this is the touring musician's dream, especially if, you know, you don't, well, I say touring musician, if you don't want to, like, lug around so much big equipment, and if you do this kind of, like, because I'm not a professional musician, you know, like, at all, you know, yeah, right? Like, I'm buying the cheapest flights. I'm usually traveling with one bag. You know, I don't have all the money to spend on these gigs, which I'm paying for myself to go to. So, you know, if I want to make sure that my set is always going to be the best it can be, I have to use my own equipment, because then there's no learning curve on other people's equipment, right? So if this is the thing that allows me to do this, I'm going to invest in it. And the other thing is as well, I never ever buy first-hand equipment. Everything I buy, apart from, I think, clothes and maybe a laptop every few years, is always second-hand. Cool. This I found secondhand in 2 weeks of this being released, and it was like £400 below the asking price. That's, and I was awesome. Like, wonderful. That's exactly what I should buy. And the same with the TP7. I don't need this thing, by the way. I actually just wanted this one. But again, it was £400 off the asking price. Now, what's the
TP7 then?
The TP7 is an audio recorder, which has a bit of a gimmick, which is the platter on this thing actually spins like a tape machine.
That's so cool. So you can, like, wiggy. Was that the idea? Like a DJ scratcher?
Whoa. Back to me, right? Roughly? Yeah, so you've got...
That's cool. Wow.
So yeah, it works like a tape machine, and it actually has feedback really from the motor that's changing this. So if I wiggle it now, just about here, maybe.
It's loose?
Yeah.
Weird.
But it's got real-time feedback from the platter at all times. So if you wiggle it, it's like a tape machine, right? Like, if you wiggle a tape machine as it's playing,
you can warble it.
It's exactly. It's the same thing. But that's, like, I don't think that's intentional. It's just that's what happens, because that's the real-time feedback of the platter. But it's a really nice thing. It's got, again, like, three stereo inputs on this one. It can... it's got a built-in microphone with quite a good compressor, and you can use it to loop, pitch shift as well. You can load your own tracks onto this as well, so you can use it as a mini deck if you want to. You can literally, like, you know, speed things up and then set loop points.
Wow.
The rocker on the side is like this thing lets you scrub through the audio quite quickly. Wow. But also, it's got BLE MIDI as well on both this. And this.
Whoa.
And then if you connect this up to a laptop or iPhone or whatever, and you rock this is the pitch.
Pitch
wheel?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, because it's a huge, huge resolution, right? So you can literally, like, just. You can make super, super micro adjustments with this. Yeah.
Like a wah-wah.
You know, put that on like a. It's exactly like a whammy bar.
Wow, and is it all aluminum construction as well?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
I mean, like, debatably those products might be, well, they are definitely not designed to the same mass production level that the Apple devices are. So for that reason, I would say that they are potentially higher quality, like potentially the only, you know, quote unquote consumer electronics that might be higher quality than Apple engineering. Because those guys are just, those folks are just crazy. They're just wild. They're mad lads. Were they based out of Sweden?
Sweden, yeah.
It's like the epitome of, like, your scientists didn't stop to ask if they should. They just, like, asked if they could. Like, that's what they're doing over there. Like, it's a million. Yeah. It's like, we came out with a mixer. It's $2,000. And it's like, what? Like, yeah. How much is the mixer MSRP?
It was £1,200. So I don't know what that is in dollars, but it's... Yeah. And the same with the recorder as well.
But I mean, like, I have like a Behringer, like, UB40 mixer that's essentially, I mean, it's effectively the exact same thing as what you showed off, but it's like way, way bigger, you know, has a giant power supply. It's heavy. Yeah, I definitely could not fit that in my pocket. So that's
battery powered.
That's like, and that's the other thing that's like crazy. Like, it's battery. So you don't even need, that can be really nice too, especially when we're playing with like kind of old stuff. noisy electronics, having it all battery powered, like, I mean, what's the power situation like? There's no, Okay. And this actually, I actually wrote this down because you mentioned this in the Marjorie interview. I wrote down, I want to see if this, like, if you, the viewer, the listener probably has no idea what I'm talking about, but I wrote down GCNL setup, pure digital. GCNL pure digital setup.
Oh yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. So
you GCNL invented pure digital. You're the first guy to ever capture like a full album audio from Nanoloop in a pure digital way. We're going to say that. We'll say that.
Yes. That is likely true. And if someone has already done it, they've never shouted about it.
From hardware, so, somebody probably captured it in an emulator.
Oh, that would technically be
pure digital, but it's not the same thing. We're talking about from real hardware made by Nintendo.
Exactly. So to unpack this as well the GameCube is has an add-on called the Game Boy Player. The Game Boy Player allowed you to play Game Boy games throughout the Game Boy's whole range on your TV, essentially, or on the GameCube. And the way that they made that work was very much like the Super Game Boy for the Super NES, where they jammed a whole actual Game Boy console in the add-on, or in the SNES example, in the cartridge. This add-on, I can't remember how I figured this out, but there is something called the GC video, which is a later in life kind of like plug, essentially, which plugs into the digital output of the GameCube. Not all GameCubes have this. I think by the end of their life, some didn't have them. And I think actually over in the US, potentially, they're harder to get hold of. That's what I read online anyway.
I own a GameCube with a digital out, but yeah, they are rare.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, but over in, over here in Europe,
they all have digital.
So easily. Almost all of them have digital. Yeah. Not, I think that they were very popular, but I don't know why, but potentially.
They probably just sold less GameCubes in the UK overall, and so they didn't have to optimize their manufacturing. But
Could be. So the digital output allows you to plug in a very specific CM. Is it no? What is it? It's
the freaking YPBPR or the
exactly
the old so they look like for the listener, if you don't know what we're talking about, there was a period of time in like 2009 when like every TV, instead of having like the traditional red, yellow, and white plugs, the analog plugs, they had like a bunch of other colors too, and like nobody ever knew what these were used for. Red, this is what we're talking green, about. It blue. Was like HDR, HDMI, HD video before we had HDMI, basically. That's what we're, so the GameCube.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it was like this special, and this is what you're talking about. It was like the special cable that now is worth like a bajillion dollars. Like, but now they have new ones now, but yeah.
Yeah, I think somebody may have figured out or deconstructed the chip at this point, but regardless of that cable specifically, you can buy something which allows you to plug in directly HDMI into this digital output port. So I was thinking, you know, like, I know that the HD signal carries digital audio, but I was wondering, is that conversion actually part of the GC video plug, or is it actually passed through from the console itself? And kind of like even further than that, is there conversion between analog sound from the Game Boy Player to digital? Turns out there's not. It's fully digital, straight from the CPU of the Game Boy Advance, which is in the Game Boy Player, straight through the GameCube to the digital output, and the GC plug doesn't change that. It just passes that straight through.
Cool.
So I was like, okay, now the difficulty here is to extract that digital audio from the HDMI, which the GC video plug gives you. But also, how do I record a set? Because when I'm writing Nanoloop 2 tracks using the Game Boy Advance, I usually have two Game Boy Advances with a mixer in between, and I crossfade between them. Digital audio mixers are not very common. They are also quite expensive. But I found a Tascam mixer from the early 2000s, which is a classic Tascam product where it feels like the product that you want, but actually it's probably not. But it does do everything you want, but only if you menu dive about three menus deep.
Tascam is so legit, dude. Like, they're just Tascam are crazy. Good. Like, the bang for buck, but it's like they're bulletproof, but they're also just like so bad. Like,
hard to use.
I love it.
They are so good. So I bought this mixer off, again, off Reverb.com, which is like the platform that I use to find like good quality used music gear. And I, the guy actually met me in London. He was working in London one day. He was like, "Hey, I'm here. Can you come and collect?" I was like, "From your work?" He was like, "Yeah, sure. You know, I'll come down and meet you." I was like, "Sick," because this thing is big. You know, we didn't want to courier it in case it got damaged. So yeah, I set up two Game Cubes,
wow,
two Game Boy players, and even that was really expensive. horrific, honestly. Bought two GC video plugs. I also bought two, in fact, I bought many HDMI audio extractors, because we can't plug HDMI into this digital mixer. You have to convert it to something called SPDIF, which is coaxial. In this case, it was coaxial digital, but it's the same. It's just the transport method's different.
Oh, I didn't know it's that exactly there the was coax, but if I always thought it was that's cool. Okay. All right. So you got to get HDMI into coaxial digital audio. How do you do that?
So I've got, it's a little box that you can buy off Amazon, but you have to buy the right one. Otherwise it doesn't work.
Yeah. There's like slight variations in the janky Chinese chips that they use and stuff.
Exactly. So I trialed a few, sent back the ones that didn't work, and then, you know, settled on these ones that did work. I think I've made a video about this on YouTube, and there's links to all the products I bought in the description.
I'm going to check it out.
They were affiliate links at one point, but nobody bought enough. So I don't have an affiliate program on Amazon anymore. Very sad. So you've got Game Boy player in a GameCube, GC video plug, HDMI into this extractor. The extracted SP coax goes into this Tascam digital mixer. And then I've got another coax into my digital audio coax plug on my sound card, which is plugged into my computer. So it's fully digital pathway all the way.
Wow.
And this was a huge, huge game changer, because if anyone who has played anything on the Game Boy Advance or has listened to anything off the Game Boy Advance knows, the Game Boy Advance is a horrendously noisy console.
Yeah, they all
are. I think the Micro is probably slightly worse.
Yeah.
But the original GBA, the GBA SP, all of them are super noisy out of their outputs. I think the SP is actually less noisy. I think it's much better, but it's still not good.
They all have just weird, like, high-pitched crunching, and just like depending on what the CPU is doing, it's like to be honest with you, at this point I boot it up and it's like nostalgic for me to just hear that like weird high-pitched whining a little bit, but I know what you're talking about.
Exactly. So this hum just makes mastering your tracks really, really difficult, because there's always like this level of noise which you can try and remove, but then you're removing harmonic elements which you probably do want in your tracks. So,
start with a clean signal.
It works, and I don't think anyone's ever done it before. And again, if they have, no one's ever shouted about it online. And when I posted a few videos about this, everyone was like, "Oh my God, this is crazy," but also really good. The side effect of this as well is that all Game Boy games work on this. So if you've got LSDJ, plug them in and you can record fully digital LSDJ as well. And LSDJ, for the listener, if you don't know, is a music tracking software which runs on the original Game Boy.
Well, very popular. Probably the most popular.
Very, very popular. Yeah.
Music software. Wow.
And
So is that how it works in the original, like in the Game Boy Advance? Do you know where does the digital, like, does the regular Game Boy Advance CPU output a digital audio signal and then it's converted into analog for the speaker? Or is this a special CPU that's in the Game Boy player?
That's a good question. I don't know. Okay. I think I did ask the question. So there's a guy called Extremes who...
There's like an alternate software player. Is that, and also I was going to ask that because the game...
Yeah, I was using that too.
For a long time, you could get a Game Boy player for really cheap, right? Like $20, yeah. I think is what I paid for mine.
Yeah.
But there was a special disc that you had to have to actually boot the GameCube into... Like it doesn't just have it built in, I guess. Like you need software to tell the Game Boy how to... Or the GameCube... Even though it's not emulating it, it needs to the instructions on what to do. So those discs were like, it's like you get the Game Boy Player for $20, but the disc is like $200, you know. But now,
they're the really rare.
All hacked open, and I was actually going to ask. So how are you booting custom software on the GameCube? What's your preferred method?
Right. So I Pico booted. All of my GameCubes, and you don't want to know how many I've got. There's quite a few. I've done Pico boot at least 3 or 4 times, I think. Pico boot is really nice. So it's using a Raspberry Pi Pico, which is like I think about the same. I think it's like £3, $3, something like that. It's very cheap. Wow. And you basically drag and drop the file to do the magic onto the Pico. You wire up a few things. It is a little bit of a tricky mod. It's not super hard, but there are quite a few wires to solder down, and then you also have to cut a space for all the wires to come in as well, so you do have to be cutting through metal and stuff. So I would say the most straightforward, but it's much easier. I don't know if you ever used the original there's like I can't remember what it's called, but it's like it's a board where like you kind of like lay it on the existing PCB, and then you've got to like solder, you know, like around pins, and then it connects to the board. Yeah. I hate those. I really hate.
Yeah.
No, not even Riven. Solid PCB, and then you have to, you know, I've got one here actually. Not the GameCube mod, but
I have a GC loader GameCube.
This is a charging USB-C charging kit for the Pocket, but what you have to do is get solder in the right place on the back of this, and that is horrendously difficult to do. And so you have to like lay this board, sorry listener, you can't see this, but you have to lay this small PCB on the existing Game Boy Pocket board, tape it into place and solder from the other side through the holes. I bought a very long time ago now, a desoldering gun, like a heated one for £90 from China, and it came, and it's the best purchase I think I've ever made in my life. A desoldering gun is just saves you so much time.
Is it just like the pump especially one? It's just like a sucker, like you hit the button and it, or is it like actually have a vacuum?
It's a vacuum.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah,
It's the best thing for modding, honestly. Like the small guns. I hate them so much. And Wick, how does anyone actually use Wick? Like solder Wick is rubbish.
Well, I'll say one of the last tool for a long time, the Casco Electronics thing for me was just like, oh, I want a 3D printer. Oh, I want like a MacBook. Oh, I want like a Game Boy. Like it was just like an excuse to buy tools. One of the last tools I bought finally was a Heiko FX 301 or whatever, the Heiko desoldering gun, dude. They're like $300, but like, oh, like I recapped an OG Xbox, and like those PCBs are like, I think they're 4+ layer, like huge ground plans. Like that thing is just like, it's like magic. Desoldering with, I will say, there's a I think it's Tech Spray. If you get desoldering wick that has this pre-fluxed, it'll work a lot better unless you want to use flux. But desoldering wick, if it's fluxed, then it'll make your board dirty. So it's like, desoldering guns if you already have one. But desoldering wick,
so good. It
depends on the situation. But desoldering guns are way better.
No, I just prefer to plug in my desoldering gun and then just use that. Yeah. I hate the wick so much. Like, it really is. I bought one to mod an Atari ST, and you know Gwen, right? Mm-hmm. he told me off more than once for modding an Atari ST because the sound chip in the ST, the 2149, has three audio channel output, right? Yep. Like you can literally, like the pins, or there are three pins on that. And I wanted to multi-track record off the Atari ST when I was making music off the ST. Yep. And I failed multiple times with multiple Ataris and broke them. And he told me off very sternly, actually. He was like, mate, what are you doing? Just don't bother. I'm like, but I really, really want to multi-track record up the Atari ST. And funny, I bought this desoldering gun, and then it worked.
Then it worked
first time.
I think I was just destroying
the boards. No, yes, no, but they like, are really expensive.
I have never seen an Atari ST here. I don't think I've ever seen one, ever.
Yeah,
I've never seen an Amiga.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I think for my 29th birthday, Graham showed up to my birthday party in London with an Amiga. He was like, here you go. I was like, oh, wow, that's sick.
Oh, dude, yeah,
yeah,
here,
really nice.
Over here, it was all Apple and education, like Apple II stuff, and then MS-DOS, so like Sound Blaster stuff. Man. That's what I like. That's my vintage.
Do you know what I've... Man, I grew up with like Windows. I think Windows 98 was maybe the first operating system, but we had a BBC Micro at some point when I was a kid. And which was like, I think my aunt's, I think it was maybe my mum's mum, my grandma, gave the BBC Micro to my dad, who had like an office under the stairs, like Harry Potter. But there was definitely
a BBC Micro in the house. What is a BBC Micro like? Is it more like a ZX Spectrum? How do you say it? ZX Spectrum? Or is it?
Yeah. ZX Spectrum here, but yeah.
Primitive than that, or more like I don't know anything about the BBC Micro.
I think it's probably roughly the same, but this was like an OG BBC Micro, I think. So it's using like BBC Basic, very.
All right, I see.
Yeah, special thing. But mentioning DOS, actually, you know, RetroArch has been out for iPhone for a couple of years now. Mm-hmm. I've just been playing, like, literally, maybe the past few weeks I've been playing the heck out of Rayman.
Really? Which one? Oh,
Rayman
on PS4.
The original
Saturn. What was it originally on?
No, DOS.
It was,
I think it was, I think it came out with DOS and
the original Rayman on DOS, dude. Like, it's fun.
Yeah, well, that's what
it's
I had
not just
up.
Impossible.
Yeah, no, it's still horrendously hard. Worse on the touchscreen. Yeah,
I can
save states, man.
Okay, that's my thing. That's the key to playing a lot more. That's my key to old video games. Like, just cheat. And this actually goes back to the analog pocket, because the analog pockets. Oh, that's cool. I'm going to play Rayman, dude. I have a very distinct memory of the first time I ever saw Rayman. I went over to my friend's house. I couldn't have been more than 5 or 6. So this would have been, I mean, what year did Rayman come out in? Was it like 95 or 96? So I think
93, I think it was. Okay. It was when I was born.
I can't remember what console. I mean, we had a Super Nintendo, so I was familiar with that. But I had gone over to a friend's house when I was, it was before first grade. And they had had, it was either a Sega Saturn or a Sony PlayStation. It might have been a PlayStation when they very first came out. And we played Rayman. Yeah. And I was enamored. It was just incredible.
The graphics in that game, right?
Yeah, and the sound.
The graphics are and the sound, Matt, but the graphics look what's that rotoscope game that came out a few years ago, the Mr. Cuppy or something?
Cuphead.
yeah, I haven't played that one, but Rayman, I mean at least it looks like the same process, but just in pixel art form, you know. Everything is rotoed, and there are so many animation frames in that game for all of the characters, and like it makes it even worse, because like Rayman, if the listener hasn't ever seen Rayman is made up of individual parts. He has a head, he has a torso, he has two hands, and then he's got 2 feet. He doesn't have arms, he doesn't have a neck, and he doesn't have legs. So you've got, you know, an animated character without arms, and all of that's being driven in code, you know, like, you know, the positioning and movement of all of this is that
they're mind-boggling. Each element's like a different sprite element, and they're like in like, because that is like, it really,
I would assume so,
because his movement is so fluid. Like I don't know if you ever played a game called Vector Man on the Sega Genesis, but it was kind of a similar thing where your character was made up of like a series of balls. And it actually, if you look at it, it looks kind of like it might've been inspired or whatever, but yeah, dude,
I'll have a look. Yeah.
And, that was cause I played like Super Mario World and stuff like that, but just booting up. And who's the developer of Rayman? Is it Traveler's Tales?
Oh no, it's Ubisoft.
Ubisoft straight up.
Yeah.
Good for them. That's when they used to make
games. Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah, Vexman looks really cool, actually. I've really never played anything on the Genesis.
Me either.
My first games console was a GBA at age 12. Like, that was late.
What was your first game?
Any sort of games console.
Pokemon?
Spider-Man 2 on the GBA.
Was it good?
Yeah, really good. I really enjoyed it. But also, you know, when you've got one game, it's like...
That's all you have.
It you're going to like that game, surely. Yeah, it was good.
What was your favorite video game growing up of all platforms?
Oh, man. Well, yeah, it was mainly like PC games, you know, really early on. So, like, I guess, like, that was the first gaming console.
Tell me more about Windows 98, man, because one of my hobbies is installing Windows 98. Like, have you installed Windows 98 recently? Dude, it boots you up, and they got, like, rock and roll music. It's like, dun, 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 dun,
oh,
dun.
Yeah.
Like, welcome to Windows 98. It's like...
Yeah.
I was watching this YouTube video.
Who made that decision?
Yeah, this guy was like...
It must have been...
Microsoft used to go all out. They used to go all hands on deck for their Windows releases, and now Windows 11 comes out, and it's like a fart with Cortana on the side. Like,
yeah, I know. And it's like, the only keynotes that I've ever seen, I think, from Microsoft are only for Windows 95 and Windows 98.
Yeah, they're so good, dude.
And that's all I've ever seen.
And the marketing campaign behind Windows was, where do you want to go today? And, like, you can watch the old, like, marketing and, like, promotional stuff, and, like, it just feels magical. Like, it just feels like this.
Yeah.
We are on the brink of something. And now it's, like, AI slop in your inbox.
Yeah.
Do you want to pay money? Man. So
tell me
more about Windows 98.
Favorite game.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's, yeah. So Windows 98, I guess we had that. Yeah. So we had something called a Tiny PC growing up.
Okay.
Tiny was just like a brand of PC which came and went. It was like around the eMachines kind of era. I always wanted, I don't know, this is really going off topic now, but do you know, man, you know, like, when memories just unlock.
Yeah,
like, my memory, by the way, is so fragmented. Like,
that's why
I can't remember
here,
anything.
Dude. I'm here to, like, unlock these core things that we would never get anywhere else.
You're doing it. It's working. You probably don't know, but there's, or maybe you do. I don't know. You know a lot of things that I don't expect anyone else to know, man. There's a comic, you know, like a magazine for kids in the UK called The Beano.
Nope. Beano.
And
Beano?
So, yeah, The Beano. Yeah.
Okay.
There is a character in there which you'll know this character, but it's not the same character, called Dennis the Menace.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with that.
I know about UK Dennis the Menace. I know that there's a difference.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Right. Well, The Beano is his home. That's where Dennis the Menace lives. Like, it's a book, like a magazine, like a weekly. I think it's weekly. Well, maybe it's monthly now, but it used to be weekly. And there'd be, you know, different characters and their own different stories and stuff. But Dennis was always, you know, well, mostly the main focus. And there'd be, like, you know, competitions that you can write in and, like, you know, do a drawing, write a poem, or kind of, like, you know, write a short story or stuff, always for kids. And there was one competition in The Beano which had this amazing translucent eMachines computer, and it wasn't the eMachines iMac ripoff. It was like a tower thing which was made of transparent plastic, and it looked so cool. And I can't remember what the competition was, but I think you had to do something quite specific, and I was like, I could never do that. But I kept this. I think I've still got it in my mum's house at somewhere, because I've got like a binder of all the Beanos that I ever bought. And that I would open up the Beano as, like, you know, like a, I don't know, 8-year-old, 9-year-old. And I was like, that PC looks so sick. And I want that in my bedroom. Yeah. But yeah, we had this tiny PC, which was like a, you know, beige box, you know, little kind of like sculpted, like plastic on the front. I'll send you a picture of it afterwards, I'm sure. But very, very specific. I just think we've still got the PC speakers from that machine somewhere.
Ooh, yeah. Bust those out, baby.
Yeah.
Those are
sick.
They're
probably quite rare at this point.
They still work.
But
just
we
as
had
well,
like a
dude.
We had, yeah, they were really good. You know, we had like the tiny printer which came with it as well. It was all tiny branded, and they had their own kind of like custom Windows install as well. It was all very, very specific. Like, it wasn't anything crazy, but they had like their own little utilities and stuff.
Cool.
And it was like, you know, it all felt like a whole package, and it was like, that was really cool. And my dad at the time, he was learning kind of like computer skills as like an adult, you know, and he was training to be like a network manager, I think. And so I think it's like very secondhand kind of knowledge was like being like passed down to me very quickly because he was on these courses and he was like, did you know you can do this, this and this? I was like, no, why would I even need to know that? And now I'm like, I'm so glad you've told me all these things about computers because it just sparked my interest, I guess. But yeah, we had all sorts of weird games. Like Rayman was you know, the kind of the coolest game that we had on DOS. And like, I could never play it as a kid. It's so difficult.
So hard.
Like once you get past like level 2, 3, maybe,
yeah,
it is horrendous.
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful game and it plays really well. It's just so, so hard. There's a game called The Crystal Maze, which is a program on Channel 4 in the UK just after I kind of like, I just missed it, but there were lots of repeated kind of programming on. The Crystal Maze is kind of like it's like an escape room, but on TV, and you see the participants and you've got a quirky kind of like host, which kind of is part of this universe, and you go to different time zones and solve challenges within those time zones.
Cool.
And as a kid, I loved that. Like that was, it was like, I mean, I would definitely, yeah, again, Crystal Maze, if the viewer has never seen this, Crystal Maze, look at
it.
The old episodes. There's new episodes with, or newer episodes now with Richard Ayoade, who is from like IT Crowd and other, you know, big name movies now. He's the host of the new one, but the original host, Richard O'Brien, I actually wrote to him once and he wrote back, which
cool.
is amazing. But yeah, really, really cool. But yeah, we had the PC game for that, which was on DOS, and it was on Acorn Archimedes.
That's another computer you'll never see in the US.
No, not at all. And but growing up in, you know, like kind of like, you know, mid-90s, late-90s, you know, UK schools, there were quite a few Acorns at school, like Acorn machines.
Really?
And I never really understood like what these machines were because you never saw them anywhere else. Like friends didn't have them at home, you know, like you didn't see them in stores. You didn't see them anywhere else, just school. And they were meant for schools. You know, they were educational machines, but they were also sold for professional kind of use as well. But the market was so small, like Windows just blew everything out essentially,
yeah.
You know, Apple to an extent.
It was a monopoly. Yeah, it really was.
Yeah, it was crazy.
According to the US government.
But this game ran on both DOS and Archimedes. And I was like, wow, you know, like that for me, I was like, okay, I need to bring this into school and somehow play it on one of the,
just test it out, see if it's different.
Yeah, you know, like, you know, it's like,
it's just weird. You're like, what is it, Acorn Archimedes? Yeah, what? And then,
yeah,
well, at
and
that
also
point,
like,
it's hard for
what's,
because you have to put yourself in the position
what's
where it's
cross-compiled?
Like, what even is a computer? Like, as a kid, you're like, I don't even, like, it's just a box. So you're, yeah. That's cool. Did you try it?
Yeah,
then?
But also like what I did and it worked great. It was fantastic. And it was exactly the same.
Wow. And it was the exactly same thing? It was the same executable? Or was it like...
No, different executables, but compiled to two different
cool.
platforms. But again, at that point in computer history, Windows is running its own, you know, it would have been DOS at that point.
Yeah.
Sorry. So that was a DOS game, but it ran on DOS. And then this also was compiled to Archimedes, which is RISC. It's ARM. It's early ARM.
That's bizarre.
So how did they do that?
It would be fun to...
How did these developers
figure that out? We should
figure
it out. I bet you it was just a lot of really hard work. Like, I don't know if you know Xenocrisis. Is it Bitmap Bureau that developed that as an indie game? I think they're based in the UK.
I don't know.
It was this indie game. They originally developed for the Sega Genesis, maybe 2018, but they ported it to like every console.
Right.
And I remember this guy showing a picture of his office and he literally just had like every variation of the Sega Genesis. Like, I think it was probably just guy in that office was like, I love the Acorn Archimedes and I'm going to port Crystal. What would you call it? What was the name of the game?
Crystal Maze.
So is it like almost like an edutainment title then? Like
it definitely was. Yeah.
History?
No. It was more just kind of like, you know, weird kind of like, you know, in the TV show, there's four challenges. There's a physical game, a skill game, a mental game, and a mystery game.
Oh.
And you've got you've got about three games in each time zone that you go to. And they're huge sets. Like, this is honestly like such a weird piece of UK history, but like, the sets itself, like all of the four sets were took up essentially the same size as a UK football pitch, which is huge. Like stadium size, which I will just Google how large those that is.
Football pitch.
So it's 110 yards long by 70 yards long, or 100 meters by 64 meters.
Okay.
So that's really nice. quite a large space, you know. Yeah. And you know, these sets filled up. Oh no, sorry, it was two. Yeah, so that times two.
Huge. Ah, okay, I'm gonna go check it out. Is
really,
it on
really
YouTube
big.
Or is
yeah.
it on BBC.
Yeah. There's quite a few episodes on YouTube. Yeah, like full episodes. Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really like fun. And like the whole point of it was kind of like for the audience, you know, at home as well. You know, I remember with my mom and my dad and my brother, we were always like, no, you know, don't do it like that. Do it like this. Like they could hear us through the TV.
That's awesome. I'm gonna have to go check it out, because I'm having a hard time drawing an analog. Like we had a show here called American Warrior where it was like,
oh, right.
It was kind of like,
so
it was kind of more like
Ninja.
Takeshi's Castle. Well, I watched MXC on Spike, so that was like,
okay.
I don't know if you know about that, but it was like they dubbed it into English and like made the voices funny. Like, yeah.
Oh, cool.
But it was Takeshi's Castle. Yeah. So it was kind of like a similar thing to that.
You know, it's like a physical kind of thing where you have to solve challenges to get to the next stage. Yeah. Right. But it's not as wacky as that. It's actually quite like, you know, like everyone is tried by the host to be pulled into the universe and actually like,
yeah.
You know, if you're in the medieval zone or the Aztec zone or the futuristic zone, or you know the other one, industrial or ocean, I think. You know, like the host is part of this universe, and he's like literally bringing you between time zones, and like everything that they're doing is not serious, but there's no reference to outside the show. It's always about what's happening within the show. It's very specific, very very. Yeah, just an odd piece of programming, but it was so popular here in the UK.
Cool, man. I want to check it out. Just kind of one of those things that took it over.
Yeah, it's mad.
We are...
Anyway, sorry.
I'm going to get kicked out of my hotel room in a couple minutes. So I want to... well, there's one really... Well, we might need to bump this over into part two because this is too fun.
Sure.
How do I even want to phrase this? You used to run an online community called Micro Collective, U Collective, which was kind of, for the listener, you can go look up the history of 8-Bit Collective, and we don't necessarily need to rehash all that, but no. You ran U Collective, and then you shut it down. It was like an online chiptune community, and I was just kind of curious, like... where are you at with social media today? Like, has Twitter kind of exploded? And, like, it's clear that Meta is basically, like, user hostile and, like, actively harmful to society. We're living in, like, AI slop. Like, YouTube is, like, suggesting me YouTube videos to make that's just, like, the most depressing and horrendous. Like, it's not even bad. It's just, like,
oh my gosh.
It's slop. It's just crap, right? Okay, so I feel like... there's never been a more important time in history, especially in the internet's history, to be producing high quality original content, right? And in the age of AI, high quality original content, like if your IQ is like 50, that's high quality original content. Like that counts, right? We need people to stop making slop and start making genuine content again. And
yeah,
the problem with that is that all of our online spaces to do that have been taken over by big publicly traded for-profit companies, right? Now we're starting to see some cool movements though, right? I think Blue Sky is a red herring. It's funded by VCs. Just Twitter
2.0. No.
But Mastodon, federated platforms, like people rethinking how we can kind of interact there. So I was kind of curious, just in closing here, what thoughts do you have about kind of the state of social media? What plans do you have in the future, and how are you interacting and using social media right now?
That's a very good question. I was literally talking to a couple of friends last night about, you know, AI's impact of, you know, kind of like, you know, trying to, you know, on, you know, content creation and kind of like, you know, and art specifically, you know, and how it is very important that we are highlighting, you know, kind of like the human, you know, how we need to highlight basically the human behind the the thing that they're creating. So even if they are using AI to create it, there needs to be a focus on the process and the human and the kind of like what are they doing with this? Yeah. If it's, you know, if it's like just, you know, like the lowest effort stuff, if AI is involved in the process, sure. I actually don't mind that much. I think I was quite against it at some point, but now that you can see that kind of like people are training their own models very specifically, and you can do this, you know, even, you know, using kind of like open data sets as a starting point, I think actually that's probably quite good. It's environmental impact. That's another conversation. I'm not hot on that, but, you know, technology is going to be technology, right? Yeah. So social media, I've essentially stopped using social media mostly apart from posting on it. I rarely, I think, I'm interacting on it at all. Mainly just because, like, I don't have enough time in the day to see, I think, and kind of like understand what's going on social media anymore. Like, I'm at work, like 9 till 6. I come home, I'm with my partner now. Like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, we're talking. Where's, you know, I want to make something, maybe some music, maybe write some code, you know, before the day's out. And then that's it. That's all the time I have, you know, and then I need to sleep. there's no time in my life for social media. But I think, yes, you know, I think it is very important to take ownership on what you're posting online as well. Like, not only just the platform, but what your output is online. I think, you know, living through the rise and fall of Facebook is so ridiculous. So you mentioned Micro Collective. Micro Collective was also ucollective.org, and the U was meant to be a reference to the micro symbol, but you can't have that in the URL. So probably a bad choice on my side, but Micro Collective, yes, that was the platform. And it was, birthed out of the downfall of 8-Bit Collective, which was a media kind of sharing site for chiptune specifically. So you could upload images and music that you created, which was part of the, you know, chiptune scene or process or whatever. But there was also a forum attached to it as well, where you could, you know, the idea was to share ideas and kind of, you know, get feedback and kind of, you know, share processes as
awesome.
Well. There were problems, and I think we do need a part two to delve into this stuff. You know, there's so much to talk about, but at its best, it was very good, you know, and I feel like, yeah. Anyway, so Micro Collective was essentially my attempt, not only one, to learn programming properly, because that was the first time I was programming anything really with PHP, but it was also like the first version of that was my first attempt at creating anything. Wow. Like, I built like the user login, the database, and everything. You're behind smart. That as well.
Yeah,
man, I'm not
that's
not
your first project, like, and it was a success. That's cool, man.
Practically, yeah,
that's really cool.
You know, I found one guide on how to set all this up, and then I kind of rolled with it. This is not quite my first project. My first project was an LSDJ patch sharing website, but the principles were the same, right? It was, you know, create, read, update, delete. So as soon as I figured that out and like used the sessions and stuff, I was like, okay, you know, we can build a forum. That's not a problem.
That's cool. And I think what I'd love to talk about more is we've seen the rise and fall of, even if we're just looking specifically at chiptune online communities, we've seen the rise and fall. If we count, we'll say 8-Bit Collective, chipmusic.org, chiptunes equals win Facebook group, noisechan.org, if you even want to count that. I don't even know where we're at.
Yeah. I've got some bad experiences with Noise Channel. To Freck, the guy that ran it, was horrendously just derogatory. Really? To my friends that were on there and part of his label, and also called me out on Twitter. They're still on there somewhere, those tweets. Was literally like, he was digging into me about kind of like me contributing to the downfall of his forum, and I'm like, man, no. Like, you know, ran this like web scraper on Micro Collective, and he was like, oh man, I've hacked into your site. I'm like, no, you haven't. You just publicly scraped
was basically like there was like this weird like false sense of, and that's the funny thing is like the two biggest chiptune artists, like, they have no reason a rising tide lifts all boats, right? And I found that also with my online shop, where it's like Nonfinite. I bought my first cartridge from him. Technically, we were competitors. R.I.P. Nonfinite Anthony. But I met him, you know, at Little Sound Assembly, and it's like, we're not competitors. We're just two nerds trying to make cool stuff happen. And when you start to get this competitive spirit, it's the opposite of what we're talking about with Shipwrecked, right? That is the green room. It's the exclusivity. Oh, yeah. It's like the ego. It's not fun, and it doesn't have any place. And so, I think the
rise and fall of all of these things, right? So, Where are we going with this? Like, you know, I would love to, talk about the chiptune communities, because I even worked with Brandon in Chipwin as well before I, you know, kind of like became this kind of, I don't even know what to talk about with Chipwin. Like, in my view, Micro Collective and Chipwin did a collaboration album, right? We set up on one of their album releases. I was one of the judges, and essentially I think I ran a competition on Micro Collective to get on Chipwin's album, you know. I can't remember. We ran a few competitions anyway. I think one was for Superbike tickets, one was for Micro Collective merch, and I think one was to do with Chipwin. And essentially I was one of the judges on one of these albums that they did, but they got criticized massively for not paying artists for their work and time. And at the time, it was an opt-in thing, you know, like they were making profit off this, but it was being put into their merch, you know, maintaining the group on Facebook, and maybe something else as well. But I really, this sounds really bad, but I was never involved with Chipwin's internals, like not once. I just want to put that out there right now, because like I never understood, I guess, like what was going on internally. All I did was select some artists, judge some artists that had, like, you know, signed up to be part of this compilation, and that was it. And I as soon as all the Chipwin stuff went down in 2020, I think it was 2019, 2020, I made the Bandcamp release of the compilation album free. Cool. And I never took profit from that either.
Cool.
Yeah.
I don't even know. A lot of the, like, those controversies, I don't know.
Compared to chiptune.org,
like I liked chiptune.org is always my favorite place. And to be honest with you, just the name chiptunes equals win always just kind of like just bugged me, because like just calling it chiptunes bugs me. Like, same. It's just like new blur kind of to me. I don't know, but I'm an elitist. I don't know. Chipmusic.org is what I like. It's my vibe. I know. Well, and I think that's just what we're talking about. Okay. Anytime that we all flock, it's happening on Blue Sky right now. We all flock to a new closed platform. Somebody's controlling it, whether it's a guy that's a Facebook group admin, or, you know, the maintainer of abc.org, or you, somebody's controlling it. Somebody's paying the server bills, right? Trash 80 pays the server bills for chipmusic.org. He probably won't always, like, I know it costs him money. So I guess the question I want to leave with is, how do we use these kind of failures to inform the work that we do in the future to build these communities? Cause I think it's super important. To have a safe and vibrant online community, something I've been thinking about a lot recently. And I think that APC, Chip Music, like they did a lot of things very good. There's a reason why a lot of people flocked to there. It wasn't because they were forced into it. There are a lot of good things that we can take away from that. But it seems to me like, I don't know, you just don't want to be in a position where you're making money off of chiptune. And that's what always made me uncomfortable with Casco Electronics.
This is it. Yeah. Like, and this is why I stopped, I think, with Micro Collective. Well, one, I had less time, because ModV, was my focus project, essentially. I was working full time, because I did all of Micro Collective in school.
Yeah. You
know? I had so much more time, because you do school from like 9 till 3.
Yep.
And then you've got so much more time in the day. So it's just a lack of time. People stop using the website as well, which is one of the reasons why I stopped it. But taking money from the community and not putting it back into the community, that is the problem that I kind of faced, actually, and really thought about when all the chiptunes win stuff came up. I don't know, man. Like, I mean, the obvious answer is crush capitalism. I don't know. You know, if we can run things for free, brilliant, we've solved it. You know, then there is no ego in terms of like the control of this. Maybe data control is then an issue, but like if you can run something which is distributed and like, you know, there isn't just one owner, then you've got something. But in the way that social media works, it's very difficult to do that, because even with Mastodon, even with federated services, someone still needs to host an instance. They still need to pay for the space with the music uploads. So if we're, you know, going to rebuild Micro Collective, for example, you know, if we want to, you know, like where's all this actually living? Where does it sit? You know, somebody needs to pay for it. The other thing that you could do, I guess, is have it as a paywall. You know, like you can only join this community if you pay a nominal fee a month. I don't want that. I don't even want to charge for that. But, you know, if we want to keep it flat and, you know, mostly accessible to a lot of people, you got to charge for it, you know? And I hate that, quite frankly. But I don't think there is another way to do this without being like, hey, guys, I need money. Please, can you give me some money?
Unless you're trash 80 and you just independently sponsor it forever, which honestly, it's not an open
This is what I was doing. Yeah. You know, I was paying, you know.
But it's not sustainable, because one day Trash 80 is going to wake up and be like, oh my gosh, my S3 bill is $200 a month. Like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah. And like, you know, and also thank you for sponsoring me for my GitHub sponsorship for such a long time as well. Oh, I forgot about that.
Well, thank you, we didn't even get into it, but you did like, you've done so much cool work with some of the products I used to make. And like, honestly, we didn't even get a chance to talk about it, but some of the hardware projects you have and future projects, like I'm starting to get that itch a little bit, and things are getting, like we talked about the RP 2040 and the Pico and everything. And it's like, I'm starting to get a little itchy. Like that hardware, I'll tell you. Okay. I literally have to go in 3 minutes, but I want to pitch you before I want to make a Game Boy Advance game or a Game Boy game. Are you familiar with like Orange FM? Like it's like an FM radio that they built into a Game Boy cart. I want to build that, but I want to make like a Game Boy Advance PDA cartridge that has like Wi-Fi. I want it to be like an internet communications device where kids can like chat and like video call on it and stuff. But I want the platform to be the Game Boy. Like I want kids to be, because now we have like Analog Pocket. We have the Chromatic, the other FPGA, the one that Palmer Luckey, the freaking weapons contractor, he made a Game Boy, and you go buy it. It's $200. I want kids to carry on Game Boys, and I want them to be like chatting in school on a Game Boy. I think it's still a viable platform. So that's my
pitch. Really cool.
Yeah,
man, that's an interesting one. That, so there was a console which was basically that, and it would use, I think, like shortwave radio or something.
Yeah.
And it was a handheld. I can't remember what it's called. I had two of them and I threw them away.
Yeah.
They were useless. But somebody has, you know, reverse engineered that protocol and you can use them.
Yeah.
The problem with that, and like, I don't want to crush the idea because I think there's something in there, but the problem with that was adults got hold of these. Adults that you don't want talking to. Immediately. I know. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Well, but that is what happened with this one.
I'm thinking about, well, yeah. That's a good
point. I know.
I'll have to think about that.
But that's...
I wanted it to be more like a 3DS. Like, because they had Pass and Spot Pass and stuff.
And the DS had the chat thing as well.
So I think it's like if you did it locally, because it's like, I know that like if we're sitting in a room together, I know that you're not like a predator. But if we're in a park, I can, I don't know. That's my pitch. So I need to wrap up, Sam. Dude, it's been so good. It's been so fun. Let's do it again soon. How's that sound?
Let's do it in a few weeks. Yeah, for sure. You know, like, you know, I want to build something with you as well. So I want to have this conversation offline as well. So let's catch up, man. Wow. Yeah, it's been so good. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Sam.
Interrobang.